Welcome to the What's Next Sports podcast, where each week we will be taking a look back at the main headlines from the previous 7 days. We'll be offering you insights, opinion, hot takes and headline acts from the world of sport. You can follow the podcast on Instagram at whatsnext.pod and Twitter at whatsnextsport. Listen, feedback, enjoy and as always, trust the process.
We are at episode 24, gents, and later in the episode, to celebrate the first Grand Tour of the Cycling World Tour season, the Giro d'Italia, we speak to a man who rode in the Giro last year. But first, how are you both? Jimmy, are you still in the form of your life?
First rain card of the season. Successful. So as far as I'm concerned, yeah, the form continues in that sense. I'm gonna christen it unbeaten. But no, yes, thank you.
No, just happy Jimmy's still in the form of his life. A successful rain card is probably up there with his average of 140. But no, I'm good, thanks, Doig. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm back in the swing of things. The long weekend, the bank holiday was much needed. It was a pleasure to have a beer or two with each of you, but back in work mode now, so not too much to report from my end other than fixtures and normality returning a little bit. But Jimmy, have you got a dick of the week for us, or the day, whichever comes better?
Dick of the week is going to Derby County Football Club. We'll have to make this plural and go for dicks of the week. Yes, they stayed up. They avoided relegation. At the end of the day, they had one win in their last. They've had one win since February or something like that. And they went on as if they'd just qualified for not only the Premier League, but also the Champions League. And it was just embarrassing to watch, to be perfectly honest. So, yeah, dicks of the week, Derby County Football Club.
Join the role of honour with Rio Ferdinand. So,
well, it's a toss up between them and Steve Bruce. But Bruce did have a good result this weekend, so I thought I'd let him off with that.
Majestic, Jimmy. I can't believe you've not mentioned it. Do you want to give it some airtime quickly, or
what? Steve Bruce on Talksport or the Newcastle game?
Either, as much as you want.
Let's go for the Newcastle game. One of the best performances I've seen them have on the front foot from the off. Still in classic Newcastle passion. Never safe at 4-0.
It's one of the most dangerous scorelines.
At 4-1, you're thinking, if they get another quickly here, we're fucked. And I think if Perez scores that one to make it 4-3, I think they equalise. I just think all the momentum's with them.
Yeah,
but the result, I think we're safe.
Well, I think they've been safe for a little while, to be honest. I think the results have... What just baffles me is, I mean, we watched the Arsenal game together the other week and they were so dire there. And then less than a week later, they turn up that performance away at Leicester, and then less than a week later, they're probably going to hand City the title by bending over backwards for them as well. So,
I actually thought the Leicester game suited us down to the ground a little bit, with the exception of Vardy. All the pace in their team had sort of been taken out. No Barnes. I can't even think where else their pace comes from, to be honest. But all of a sudden, they play such a high line that it allowed us to get in behind. Credit to Steve Bruce. I thought he did get things right on Saturday.
Well, that's why he's in the running for Manager of the Month and all the awards that are coming his way.
Well, I mean, as you said there, we could still be playing Arsenal today and we wouldn't have scored. But apart from that...
Should we get on with the rest of the headlines? It's been a little while since we've done a roundup, so a few bullet points to get through. Tyrrell Hatton tested positive for COVID as McIlroy got back in the winner's circle. City beat PSG... and Chelsea beat Madrid to set up an all-English Champions League final. Arteta failed to get past the man he replaced at Arsenal as they fell short against Emery and Villarreal in the Europa semis. Moyes was voted Premier League Coach of the Year at the London Football Awards. Mayweather v Logan Paul is back on and sparked a riot at the press day with brother Jake. Labuschagne is back for Glamorgan and getting out to old fox Darren Stevens as England favourite Jimmy Anderson also got him out. There's been the NFL draft. There was a social media boycott and there was a cancellation of the Man U Liverpool fixture due to crowd protests and breaking into the stadium, which we might get onto. Buendia won the Championship Player of the Season as the Football League promotions and relegations were confirmed. Ollie Pope is still scoring runs. Hamilton won back-to-back in Portugal and Spain as Mercedes also announced that Grosjean will drive an F1 car again in France as a test driver for them. Chisora lost to Parker after threatening to walk off, needing his mum to convince him to fight. Canelo broke Billy Joe Saunders' orbital bone to win in 8 rounds, sparking much hysteria about quitting on his stool, especially after the heat he gave Dubois not too long ago for similar. New Zealand are the number one ODI team in the world, and England dropped to fourth despite only playing Bangladesh in a 3 months. The IPL has been cancelled finally due to COVID risks as the rate climbs in India and the players were starting to test positive. Selby won a fourth world title at the Crucible in front of a full 980 capacity crowd, the first capacity crowd at a sports event in England in over a year. Hebben won the All North East Clash at Wembley to win the FA Vars, though their title defence was the shortest in history, as just 5 days later they lost in this year's competition. And lastly, the Lions squad was announced for the summer tour, with Gatland making many bold calls. Any of those to touch on, gentlemen, before we move on?
Lots to touch on there. Did you see the state of Billy Joe Saunders? Was it his x-rays?
Literally one punch. It was unbelievable.
I haven't seen the x-rays, but I've seen the picture of his face, which was probably better than what the x-ray looked like.
Oh, you see, I hadn't seen the picture of his face. I saw the x-ray today. Fuck me.
There was one, the left upper, I mean, he was getting outboxed, and Canelo is just a beast for anyone, but there is one punch in that eighth round with about a minute and a half to go where Saunders sort of ducks in, Canelo gets sort of a left body shot that he's going for that actually he can adapt, and he goes and he catches Billy Joe in the eye. And as Billy Joe looks up, it's already the size of a moon on his face. It's unbelievable. And that must have just cracked like a plate when you drop it.
It looks like it's come away. That's the mad thing in the x-rays. It looks like it's come away a good half a centimetre from his face. Horrible. Just from that one hit there and then. What a punch.
He's done well to even survive the minute and a half, and like literally survive a minute and a half without losing his eyesight. I guess the heat that he's getting is because of all the comments he made to Dubois about being a quitter, saying, you would need to carry me out the ring. You would need me to have lost my skull, my teeth, my this, that, and the other. But
he did lose his skull.
Well, he was about to lose his eyesight. He couldn't have fought on any longer. He gave a decent account of himself, but he wasn't going to hurt Canelo, and Canelo was always in the later rounds, which is why AJD put money on him winning in eight. So that was cash in the bank. But anything else to touch on, Tinnis?
A couple of ones I kind of got mine. Obviously, we were a little bit late on this week's pod with the Chris Kirkland one sticking out. So I suppose we could touch on the IPL being cancelled. Was it the right thing to do? Could it be moved? I've seen different rumours of it coming to England or going elsewhere, where the cases aren't obviously as high as India. And thought we'd touch on the Man United-Liverpool game being postponed. Obviously, we were together when watching the Newcastle match when that all kicked off, and we were kind of all a bit shocked of what happened. So I just thought we'd touch on them. I suppose starting on the IPL, was it the right decision in the end? And I think it was. But
Yeah, I think it probably was. Don't really think you can carry on. It was a little bit like it was in England when COVID sort of kicked off. I know it's a lot worse than India now. There was no way they could have kept that going, even if it was to keep the morale high. I listen to a couple of people say that trying to socially distance in India is just now and impossible. You've almost got a luxury in the UK of being able to do what we did, go into a national lockdown. It's just not possible in India.
Yeah, and I think the cricket itself is obviously, everyone was saying, oh, it's something to keep the morale high, but I mean, the photos of it outside, there was people trying to get glimpses of their favourite cricketers. So actually, they were bringing people together. As much as the grounds were empty, there were still people outside the grounds waiting to get the ball if it went out the ground, or just to get a glimpse of Kohli and their favourite players, which they're always going to do in India. It's like when it was transfer deadline day here and Gareth Bale signed for Tottenham, there was 20, 30 of them outside Tottenham's training ground. But in India, there's hundreds of people just wanting to see their players.
I think the other thing as well, when you think about comeback of cricket last summer and the success around that, it was all based on bubbles and taking people away from their families for months on end and locking them in hotel rooms and almost saying you can't actually even go see the rest of the lads in the squad. Like, once you've finished playing, you've got to sit in your hotel room. But only having that, because last year they only played at Nationals at Southampton and Old Trafford, didn't they?
Yeah, it didn't go anywhere else.
Yeah, so all of a sudden in India, I mean, they're playing across every city, every ground.
Yeah, they were doing like bit travel. They were doing bit to bit. So you saw the photos of them all in the hazmat suits, traveling from kind of city to city to play in different places. And I think that's possibly where they went wrong. But I think at some point they were going to have to cancel it either way. The fact that a couple of the players got COVID. because they went for an x-ray or a scan. That was always going to happen. You're never going to get through a kind of a whole competition without someone needing to go to hospital.
I think as soon as it reached and sort of breached those players' bubbles, they were in trouble because, as you say, there were crowds gathering to catch a glimpse or whatever. Remember the outcry when, was it Dan Lawrence, took a photo with a fan in a pub in Australia when there were no COVID cases and they were semi-exiled from the squad and things like that. And that was where they had it under control. It wasn't still rising numbers and horrific death totals and positive cases in India. I think, to be honest, it's probably greed dictating that they're even looking at taking it elsewhere. They're probably better actually just saying, you know what, we got this wrong. We'll go to October, November, this time next year in Dubai, in South Africa again, England at the back end of the summer. They're only thinking about playing it again for money, which is probably wrong in these times, considering the state of play in India at the moment.
Should it have even gone back to India in the first place? Bearing in mind, it went to Dubai and it was ran very smoothly. There was no kind of, we should have ever gone back to India. Or
but they had crowds in for, they had 50% crowds in and some full crowds in for the England-India series, didn't they? So at that state of play for cricket in India, it was fine. Fine's probably the wrong word, clearly, but they were managing it and they wanted those crowds to be there for their own competition. So I guess similarly, if they'd said, look, they're going to take the English Premier League out to Brisbane, Melbourne and Sydney for Newcastle to play Man City, whoever, on Friday night, we would kick off about it. So naturally, the people would be giving the BCCI a load of rubbish if they were taking another competition, which you've got to remember for a number of years has spent two or three different editions of the IPL out of India. You probably got, if they thought they could get away with it, which clearly they did safely, you probably had to give them the benefit of doubt for having it there. So,
fair enough. I just kind of, because we mentioned it last week or in the last podcast about should it have even gone ahead, should it be cancelled? Just thought we could touch on it now that it actually had been cancelled. Obviously, there's other cricket going on over in England, and obviously, our cases like today, I saw the news that there's no COVID deaths, which is great for us. But then the other thing I suppose we missed out on slightly was the Manchester United protest and the game being postponed against Liverpool.
Well, the thing about this is the protest, and similar to the, I guess, the whole Super League thing in general, is what's the punishment? What's the cost of the game? And actually, the cost of that game, for United fans who have protested against the Glazers for years, is actually bothered if it's being played three games in 5 days or something ridiculous, three games in 6 days or four in seven, whatever. The fans aren't that bothered about that. And obviously, United will be a little bit gutted that over the weekend, Maguire's picked up an injury. Obviously, in that time, they've got some big games. They've potentially got the chance to be within 4 points by the time City next play against Newcastle in the title. It's sort of squeaky bum time, whatever. I think they've got a right to protest. I think I can't believe anyone possibly thought when they announced the Super League, they haven't looked at the fixtures and thought, actually, if there's protest towards this, we are playing Liverpool, in theory, whatever people say, the biggest game in English football, whatever, is in a week or two's time after we've announced it. That is a prime opportunity for people to make some sort of statement and make themselves heard. The best part about it is that people were on the pitch, they were taking corner flags. Apparently, people who had got into the ground had taken enough footballs that actually, had they then managed to get the game on, they didn't have enough balls left at Old Trafford to actually be able to legally play the game with Premier League rules. So whether that was on purpose or not, or whether it was someone just taking a souvenir and they fell foul of that, I don't know. They couldn't probably play the game because they wouldn't even be certain that everyone was out the stadium and then someone could have got hurt. But did United get in trouble for not stewarding it properly? I don't know.
As I imagine there's certain security protocols they'd have to follow. And then, I mean, it wasn't just a couple of fans, was it, that had snuck in and got over some little barrier. It was a case of there was a couple of hundred, if not 300 fans in there all over the ground, up in the boxes, smashing up. I mean, at the end of the day, they've protested and they've cost the club a fortune, I'd imagine, because there'll be a decent amount of damage in there. And then, I mean, my favourite bit was the kid falling off the goal. I thought that was great.
I like the video of the lad trying to replicate Wayne Rooney's bicycle kick. There was, to be fair, there was some comical stuff coming out of it. It was brilliant. Did you see the lad shouting at Graeme Souness and Micah Richards when they were obviously
on the balcony
doing the Sky Sports thing there? Just, I wasn't keen on it. And I know that everyone's got a right to protest, but I think I don't know. Maybe it's just I just thought it was a little bit off. The whole pitch invasion. You got to write a protest, but I thought that was taking the piss a little bit.
I think if the protest was done right outside the ground and everything was done right, then yeah, no dramas. I think it's a case of that actually they got on the pitch. Someone could have seriously got hurt. There was a lot of kids in there that were doing it for the fun of it and probably didn't really just thought, oh my God, I'm going to get on Old Trafford. Didn't really think what they were doing. So, I mean, how many of them are real football fans and how many of them just wanted to go in and just to say they'd gone in and done it?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing. The people who there's interviews of people who were outside protesting who were genuine football fans, and they're saying, well, we didn't even come close to considering going on the pitch. We were here for a reason, and that was to protest in the right way. So I think it was just a case of Man United got it wrong. Some of their fans got it wrong. As a Liverpool fan, it's disappointing not to see the game, but yeah, that's what it is, really. Isn't it?
The problem about that, I guess, is though that, as you say, a lot of the fans didn't really know what they were doing there. Some people were going along with it, whatever. There's also people outside the ground protesting against the owners. And as soon as TalkSport or Five Live or whoever it might be say to them, if the Glazers give Ollie an unlimited budget in the summer to apologise for what's gone on, is all forgiven? And they go, yeah, yeah, probably, that's fine. And you thought, well, what's the point of the protest?
It's madness. They've had an unlimited budget in the past. I mean, if you think of the money they've spent on players, and they're still miles off being... I know they're second in the league at the minute, but I mean, I look at teams like Liverpool and they get Van Dijk and Henderson back. And after a blip season this year, they'll be above them next year. I think Chelsea under Thomas Tuchel at the minute look best more likely to challenge City for the title if you consider that the two games he's played against them, he's beaten them and they've got a Champions League final coming up. There's potentially being moved to Wembley now where there'll be a lot of Londoners there. There's obviously going to be a lot of Londoners in Wembley. That was a stupid statement. You know what I mean? Lots of Chelsea fans.
They look organised, Chelsea. They look good under him.
Man United next year.
Do you think they beat City? Tottenham? Did Chelsea beat City again for a third time, or is 3 too many to ask?
You know what? I fancy them.
It wouldn't surprise us. Who would you rather win? I couldn't really care.
I'd rather City win because I like Guardiola. I like the way they play. Yes, they've spent a lot of money in it, oil money and whatnot, but I fucking hate Chelsea.
I'd like to see City win it because I think it's been just almost to get that like rounding off of the project, right? They've won the Champions League. Finally, can everyone just sort of say they've done what they're meant to do and now they can just be a good football team and accept, yes, it's done with money. United have still spent more money since the oil money came in than City have. Because they still spend these massive transfers when they go and spend 80 million on Maguire and 90 million on Pogba back and things like that. City, yes, they spend money, but...
What was the first year of the oil money? Was it the year that we went down, 08, 09?
Was it not the Rubinho where they plucked him out of Chelsea?
Yeah, but I think that... Because their last game before they got taken over, they got beat something like 7 or 8 or 9-1 off Middlesbrough. Away.
There was a photo of a fan had put that on the other day on Twitter. I can't remember what it was.
But anyway, I mean, who's won more trophies since the oil money then? Them or Man United? You got to assume them, considering...
City still. United haven't won a league for 10 years, have they?
2013 was our last title, but they obviously would have won a couple before that. FA Cups. They obviously had a decent... They did have a decent trophy spell under Mourinho. League Cups, Europa League and FA Cups.
But City won the League Cup 4 times in a row, just about 3 times in a row. So, and they've won 3 leagues, haven't they? So
it's like us and the Jimmy Bell before this season.
Any of those other ones to touch on quickly before we move on? The Mayweather Logan Paul back on?
Nah, pair of cocks.
Yeah,
it's... actually, a pod of pricks if you throw the other Paul into it. I saw something today saying it was going to be like a 2-on-1 tag team WWE Hell in a Cell.
It'll be funny as hell if he braid them both as well. I couldn't really care less who wins, but...
I wouldn't. You couldn't pay me to watch it.
No. I'll wake up in the morning, look on Twitter once, and then turn and then not be bothered by it. But no. It'll be great if they knocked each other out at the exact same time. Would be my perfect thing, but then they'd probably end up doing it again, wouldn't they? So maybe not.
If you're talking exhibition, Matt, this is probably a discussion for another day, but... Could you think of like a celebrity exhibition match that you'd like to see? So I'm thinking like Peter Crouch on his podcast talks about his time in England came to an end when players like Andy Carroll started breaking through. So, like, Peter Crouch versus Andy Carroll, hell in a cell.
Roy Keane, Alan Shearer?
Yeah, like, Roy Keane, Vieira, tables, ladders and chairs. I don't know. Like, I'm just going to throw a footballer, another celebrity and a format of wrestling into the ring and see what exhibition match you come out with. Lewis Hamilton versus Verstappen.
Just EastEnders v Corrie in a Royal Rumble or something like that.
Yeah. Genuinely, you could have absolutely anything.
Kirk from Corrie against Big Phil Mitchell, last man standing. Done.
Fucking hell. Me peeling Kirk off the canvas at the end of it.
Not right. Go on, what were you going to say?
I wasn't going to say anything. I was going to try and move us on pretty quickly from that. Tinners, we'll come to you first. What's next?
I just thought with kind of most of the playoffs, the promotions, relegations confirmed, that albeit not all of them in the Premier League, I think we've kind of agreed that, well, Fulham will go down as well. Just who we think will do the best? Will any of them come straight back up? Who will get promoted out of the playoffs in the Championship, and how will Norwich and Watford do? And then obviously, do we think your favourite team, Sunderland, will come up in the playoffs or not, Jimmy?
They're not the informed team at the minute. My money's on Blackpool.
Who would you rather come up?
I couldn't give a fuck as long as it's not Sunderland. I don't even know who else is in it.
Blackpool have got Oxford because Oxford leapfrogged the Cowley brothers in Pompey on the last day, so they missed out. Although I think they actually fell below Charlton as well. So it's Blackpool, Oxford and Sunderland. I've got Lincoln. So I think...
Sunderland should be the team that come up from that. But Blackpool are playing well at the minute. They're playing the best football. They've had the best results. I'm going to say Blackpool.
But Sunderland are in League One are the out-of-form team, a bit like Swansea are the out-of-form team in the Champions. Like Swansea with a team that people were almost trying to fix results so they could play playoffs in the Championship.
In a way, it's funny when you look at... I don't really know how often this happens, but it'd be interesting to see how often third place actually comes up, because I think at the end of the season, when they miss out on the automatics and they realise they're in the playoffs, there's a little bit of a holiday mode coming into it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I've actually told this story on here. A mate of mine's really good mates with Sammy Amiobi. And a couple of years ago, he went off to Cardiff and he came back and he said that while he was on loan there, they had the last promotion spot. And they said it was really tight. It was on goal difference. And there was a team below them playing really well. And the manager brought them in and said, right, lads, you know, last three games, big push. Secure this playoff place and we can try and get ourselves into the Premier League next year. And all the players sat there and went, yeah, great idea. Captain called a meeting when Gaffer left and he said, oh, can all the players just stay behind? I want to have a quick chat. And Captain turned around and he went, lads, in reality, we're not going to go up by the playoffs. So let's lose the last couple of games and fuck it off and have a longer summer. Lost the last three, didn't go up.
Brentford have finished third, haven't they? And they've had Ivan Toney in form. And they, to be fair to them, I think they've won the last three of the last four. So we saw them when they beat the Toon in the Cup. They were everyone's sort of London glory team, etc. They're playing Bournemouth, who are obviously the story in terms of having the three relegated teams come straight back up. I reckon it probably comes out of one of those two, whoever gets out of their game.
Barnsley are playing good football.
Yeah, but
to see Barnsley come up.
Yeah, I'd love to see Barnsley come up as well.
That's what I'd want to come up at the start of the year, though.
Well, they were, but they're playing some decent stuff now. They've had some decent results. Did you see the video of Warnock at the end?
No.
So, obviously, Middlesbrough played them on Saturday. There's a video of Neil Warnock at the end of the game shaking hands with all the staff in his broad Yorkshire accent saying, go on, do it for Yorkshire. Get up. Go all the way, lads.
Well, Barnsley are playing Swansea, which, like you said, Doig, Swansea aren't in the best form. So, arguably, if Barnsley get out of that, then Brentford get into it, they're going to be dead nervous because they failed the last couple of years, although they've got close. Bournemouth, if they get through, again, will be nervous. They've got one of the biggest squads in the Championship and haven't really done an awful lot. Obviously, they finished sixth, that's great. But I think Barnsley might just have a right good go at it, and why not? I mean, they might end up losing a couple of their players to better Championship teams next year, so you might as well have a right good go at it.
I'm going to Barnsley-Brentford final.
Haven't Barnsley just been taken over? So if they come up, they might have some coin to spend as well.
I hope so.
It'd be great to see Barnsley up.
Norwich and Watford
versus Leeds.
Do they have a chance coming back up?
I think there's more chance of Watford doing well, as in staying up. I think Norwich will do the exact same thing as last time. They've got some decent players, but like Pukki won't score the goals he scores again this year. They've obviously got Buendia, who's a very good player.
They'll lose
Cantwell as well, but like you said, they'll probably lose Buendia. Max Aarons is the right back that kind of everyone's linked with, so in a sense. So if he has a half decent year, then they'll lose him as well. I just think they're a very same team. They'll come up and they'll go down. I think Watford have got a better chance of staying up. They've got a proper squad.
I could see Norwich doing a little bit like what Fulham did this season, in a way of coming up, getting relegated, coming back up and probably getting relegated straight away. A bit of a yo-yo club. Can't see them spending the money. Probably have to bring some loan players in. I think they'll keep a hold of all their players. I can't see them selling Aarons, Buendia yet. I think if they go down next year, I think they'll all leave. But I think their main problem was they obviously came up last time and Pukki had scored all these goals. And yeah, he had a great start. He scored a hat-trick against us. Fucking Stevie Wonder could have scored a hat-trick against us in that game. We were terrible. I think they need to bring a better striker in, someone who'll actually score them the goals. Dwight Gayle's another example. Bangs him in the championship. He might get you 7-8, decent backup number two, but
yeah,
he's not going to keep you in the league.
One of their key players is Ollie Skip, and it's what Spurs decide to do with him as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Stay at Norwich for a year, then they've got a half-decent chance and they're not having to make too many changes.
Could you see another club coming in for him, though? Could you see I don't know who's stayed up this year. A Burnley, for example, you know.
Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, I can see him going straight back down to the top end of the championship, have another year down there.
I suppose it depends what if Norwich turn around and say, we want to stick with the same team, he'll play the exact amount of games as he has this year. Basically, he'll play when he's fit, as long as he's playing well. Then Tottenham could just say, all right, Norwich.
I can see Norwich. He is solid. He is decent for, and they all really like him. I'd be lying if I pretended I'd watched that much Championship football, especially Norwich. But I can see them going and trying to get like Adam Armstrong, because they'll not be able to get Tony. And obviously, if Tony comes up, he'll stay at Brentford. But if they don't, he'll go to somewhere like a Brighton or somewhere Palace that can probably pay a little bit more. But I can see them maybe getting like a second-rate Championship striker, a Gale, to try and prove it in the Premier League and just not quite come off for them alongside them. So, I think...
Yeah.
Go down pretty quickly.
I think Watford will stay up. I think they'll stay up. I think they'll have a decent squad, enough experience in there from previous Premier League years.
I think the problem is, though, you look at the Premier League and the bottom three are, like, Burnley at 17th. I don't think Burnley will get relegated for years to come. And then Southampton, then Brighton, then Newcastle. There's not that many teams who you're saying are scraping for relegation other than the bottom three.
If
Dyche goes to Palace, Burnley are going down.
Yeah. If Dyche goes to Palace, they're down. And if we keep Bruce, I think we're probably in the mix again next season. I don't think there's any denying that. There we go. There's my prediction now. For the end of this, we're down next year.
Nice. Out of the three teams who are getting relegated, so Fulham, West Brom and Sheffield United, obviously Fulham isn't confirmed yet, but have any of those got a chance of coming straight back up, do we think?
Fulham would be the obvious one, but a lot of their players this year are on loan and I can't see a lot of them staying on.
They've got a completely different team next year, haven't they? I think West Brom had a similar team last year in the Championship to what they've had this year in the Prem, to what they're going down with again. So I think they've probably actually got the best chance. And I think Allardyce actually might be quite determined to try and bring them back up if he stays.
Yeah, I think Sheffield United will struggle for a few years as well. I think they'll go back to lingering for a little bit, depending on who they get in. But I think they'll go and struggle for a bit. But I think if a lot of Fulham's loan players are lads who will get snapped up by Premier League players because they've done okay. The centre-halves have both done pretty well. With what I've seen of them, that Anderson, he's looked like a proper centre half, and the young lad from Man City, he's a young lad from Man City, so someone in the Premier League will take a punt on him. That he's had a decent enough year. And then they've got a couple of midfielders as well as Luckman and Madger, who are both on loan. If they keep them for next year, they will come straight back up, but they have to keep six lone players. They can't
afford. They won't be able to afford Luckman. I mean, they might get Magic, as there's talk of him being for about 10 mil. And I think he's done it in the Championship. He scored goals with Sunderland, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah,
was
yeah
that he didn't get
no, because he went in the January of the Netflix series, didn't he?
Yeah, but he scored a few goals, didn't he? I mean, they've still got Mitrovic, who we haven't seen a lot of this year.
Mitrovic is another example of someone who'll get you 20 league goals in the Championship, but
is that not how they're going to come back up? Madra and Mitrovic up front, and they'll probably battle the way back up. I think they will lose some players though.
I quite like Scott Parker as a manager. I think that Fulham play a decent brand of football. I just don't think they've had the players at times this year.
Yeah.
Three wins at home all season, that's relegation fodder, that.
Do you think if they had the... Because when the start of the season, he kept the same team, didn't he? He tried again. He said, look, here's your chance kind of thing. And they were shotgun at the start of the season. And then when they got the loans in halfway through the year and he started giving everyone a right good go, if they had the team they've got now, do you think they would have stayed up? That they've played with since January. Do you think
results haven't been brilliant? They had a little run where they picked up, like, they basically had the run that Newcastle have had now, and everyone was saying that's them, they're safe. But then they've dropped off again.
Because the one, so obviously Brighton are there as well. What do we think? Will Brighton stay? Or if Potter stays, do you think they're always going to be okay next year?
Yes.
Watford staying up. So who
if they keep Bissouma, yeah.
So if the three teams come up and no one loses their manager, so Dyche stays at Burnley, Potter and Bissouma stay at Brighton, do the three teams that come up just go straight back down, do you think? Because I don't know who goes down from the teams who are staying up this year.
I think it's hard to tell because you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, if Newcastle have another year with their injuries like we had, and all of a sudden you haven't got Wilson, Sam Maxman for long periods of time, then... You saw what we were like about them. We were clueless.
Yeah.
I think we'll be down there. As Doggy said, if Dyche goes to Burnley, I think they'll be down. I think he's the only thing that's kept them in the league the last couple of years. Brighton, in the sign of player to actually score them goals, to play good football and get in those positions, but can we get an Ivan Toney and Adam Armstrong that might find the net?
I was going to say, if Brentford don't come up, then Brighton, you'd have to say, have to break the bank and go and get Ivan Toney or Adam Armstrong. And
Again what they've done in the past. And I mean, when they signed Neil Mopay, all they did was sign the leading scorer in the Championship that season. So really, is it... I know these players, they're younger. Adam Armstrong's got a bit of Premier League experience, albeit a long, long time ago. Ivan Toney put up incredible numbers last season. But it's doing the same thing and expecting different results. And I'm not sure if it'll continuously pay off for them. I think they're better off going and almost breaking the bank for a proven... I know you say proven Premier League striker, well, who'd you go and get? But like... I don't know. Even coming to Newcastle and saying, how much for Wilson?
Yeah,
well, he's not stepping backwards. They'd be better off trying to go and unsettle Danny Ings from Southampton.
Yeah, they probably would. I mean, they've been terrible as well.
They've got the worst form in the league since they were top.
They could quite easily slip and keep going down.
Stop the count.
Yeah, since they were stopping the count.
Literally since that. That was against us as well. That is karma. That was a tough Friday night viewing.
One of the last things I suppose to talk about is the three teams that went down from the Championship. So, Jimmy, obviously your dicks of the week with Derby stayed up by a point. Sheffield Wednesday went down bottom. Obviously, they had the points deduction as well. Rotherham and Wickham, I'd argue I haven't watched any football at all. I've kept a little eye on Wickham because Akin Fenwer, and it's just they're one of the teams that were always going to go down. But I think they did quite well to survive till the last game of the season. But any of those three to come back up? Sheffield Wednesday, if they keep the players, would they come straight back up?
You never really know, except when you think of Sunderland going down a couple of years ago, I thought they'd come back up immediately, and they obviously, as everyone's fully aware, they haven't. Sheffield Wednesday would be my pick, but
I haven't got a clue. I can't sit here and pretend I've watched a great deal of it or any of it.
I'm the same, but obviously a little bit like Derby, they've done quite well in the last couple of years, and you can see how quickly, if you get a couple of things wrong, how quickly you can be at the top to the bottom. I mean, just looking at the teams who were kind of 17th and below, Notts, Forest, Birmingham, Bristol City, and Huddersfield, they were all kind of either challenging or being Premier League clubs in the last few years, and now they're basically at the wrong end of the Championship.
But Bristol City's fall surprised me a little bit. I thought they were sort of pushing playoffs about 3-4 months ago at Christmas.
And they started the season really well, I think.
But even in terms of that League One now, yeah, because you've got Pearson and Barton and Bristol, haven't you?
I fancy Pearson, you know, to do well with them next year.
In terms of League One, everyone says about the Championship, like you look at the teams, they're such a hard division, etc. You look at League One now, even if, say, Sunderland or Blackpool, one of them is an ex-Premier League team, stays down there, you still have Charlton are going to be there next year, Portsmouth are going to be there next year, Ipswich are going to be there, Gillingham are relatively Football League established, Burton, Football League established, Wimbledon, Wigan, Bolton have just come up, Cambridge United have just come up winning the division. Like, there's decent teams down there, which is literally throw them into a hat, whoever has a decent 46 games is coming up. It's not a case of they are going to come up. There's very few teams get relegated and are nailed on to come back up, which is why I think it is quite impressive that Norwich and Watford have done it automatically. I think it's why it's always impressive when Newcastle have done it. Those, I don't think it's as easy to be relegated and come straight back up, as shown, as you say, by the likes of Sunderland, Bolton, Sheffield Wednesday, who are now dropping through the divisions, even though it's over a few years. Clubs can free fall quite quickly.
Yeah, it's interesting, especially when you think a couple of clubs do come out. I know Hull City have gone down and gone straight back up. That's obviously quite impressive, because it's going from Championship League One, isn't it? That's a big, footballers see that as a big step, don't they? When I certainly think about it, I think that's quite a big drop off, but I don't think it probably is that big anymore. I think it's all
standards terrible. I've seen a couple of things from League One, mainly piss takes on like social media, but the standard of League One is miles away from, I don't even know, like, it's obviously miles away from the Premier League, but I think back to when Newcastle were in the Championship and your Barnsleys, your Rotherhams, they came to play us and we absolutely murdered them. And these teams are better than the teams in League One. So all of a sudden,
George Honeyman's just won League One Player of the Year.
Yeah.
George Honeyman.
All right, that kind of sells it a little bit worse than what I was thinking it was. Then. Right then, so we're thinking Watford are going to stay. Watford will come up and stay up. Norwich will struggle again. And when we think a couple of Norwich players will leave at the end of that season, and then we're kind of I'm backing Barnsley to come up. Not that I think they will. I just want them to.
I'd like Barnsley to come up. I think it'll be Brentford. But I'm also going to put this out on the line: Bristol City next season. I think Nigel Pearson will bring them up.
Nice early. Put a tenner on it.
Might do, actually.
Right.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Right, Doiga. You've got our headline up this week. What's next?
We were joined by one of the guys who has ridden in the World Tour this year. He is our cycling brand, but also EF Education Nippon, as they are now known. The famous pink outfit. He rode in the Giro d'Italia last year, and with it being this week the start of this year's edition of the Giro Italia, we thought we would catch up quickly to get an inside track on all things alternative calendar, but also Grand Tour racing with EF Education Nippon rider Lachlan Morton. Enjoy.
I'm really excited for this, and one of the most recognisable figures in the professional cycling peloton. He is an Australian riding out of Colorado for the equally recognisable EF Education Nippo team. Lachlan, I appreciate it is early in the morning for you, so thank you so much for joining us. And as always, firstly with our guests, how are you?
I'm good, mate. Just hanging out in Colorado. It's freezing cold here, but no, I can't complain.
you've recently been riding alongside your EF teammate Alex Howes in the Old Man Winter Rally. How was that as a virtual, socially distanced event? How has it ran? And I guess ultimately, how did you get on, or are you getting on?
That was Well, it's an event that they have every year here in a town like about 10 miles from Boulder. And it's basically just like a participation event that I think is a 100K loop and then a 50K loop and then there's a 10K run that you can do. And regularly they have it like, I think it's the first weekend of Feb, which here is generally pretty cold. And it's kind of a mixture of dirt and road. But obviously this year, they couldn't hold it as a big mass start event. So they basically, you entered and then you could complete the course and set a time. And over the course of 2 weeks, I think you can go and do it with the idea of, keeping everyone separated. So it's obviously not the same as a race, but it's cool to see, you know, anyone who can get an event going and shoot it off successfully. It's pretty cool at the moment. So, yeah, we got involved in that and went out and gave the course a little bit of a nudge last Saturday, which was, yeah, a nice little shock to the system after the off-season. So, yeah, it's good fun.
You are, of course, a World Tour road cyclist and you get to pull on that iconic Rafa pink EF jersey when racing, as well as getting to wear the iconic Rafa Palace collaboration at the Giro last year. How good are those kits? How much of a say do you get on the kit as riders this year? There's been one or two law-abiding changes to the designs. Is that something that you put an input in, or is it you just pull it on and you go out and ride?
Yeah, no, we didn't get any input. It's kind of when you, I had an existing relationship with Rafa before I joined DF. I kind of know people who are involved in that process. And to be honest, it's not a process that I really want to be involved in. Sounds pretty difficult. There's a lot of different companies and people that you have to, you have to please, you know, while also trying to create something that is unique and stands out and is true to them as a company. So I think from the way I understand it is the Rafa kind of shoot for the moon and then, you know, they have to kind of slowly tone it back to bring everyone you sort of to a spot where everyone's sort of content with how it looks. I haven't got my kit this year, but I saw the release online. It looked pretty cool. But that seems like it's just another little poke at the UCI, which I'm sure we're going to hear about, but whatever. I think like there's bigger worries.
There's probably bigger concerns than
our jerseys. I'll let them get upset about it.
You've previously won multiple stages at the Tour of Utah in your road career, as well as winning the GC there in 2016. You were at the Tour Down Under last year, as well as also being at the aforementioned Giro d'Italia. What was that experience of riding in a Grand Tour like, from the build-up, the preparing the legs, all the way through to ultimately competing and completing the tour, working for the team across those 3 and a bit weeks?
Yeah, it's good fun. It's a bit of like a process. Obviously, preparing yourself and making the team, and then even just spending a month away from home. You know, even if you weren't racing, you kind of have to like get your shit together a bit. I actually really enjoyed. I enjoyed the Grand Tour format because it's a lot of different opportunities, and having not raced a lot on the road last year for a while with the big break, and then I kind of was doing other things. It actually gave me the chance to kind of ride into it and find my my feet a bit again in that style of racing. But actually, yeah, I enjoy the Grand Tour racing, I think, probably the most of all the road racing, because it's kind of, it's a bit of an adventure, you know? I mean, we're pretty well looked after and there's not too many variables, but just with the nature of the racing being so difficult and the courses are long, you kind of have this long experience that you won't forget. And you form bonds with your teammates and even, you know, competitors through just this sort of shared experience on the road. And obviously, you know, the Grand Tours are the pinnacle of road cycling, or men's road cycling. So, I mean, to be involved in that is always, you know, a privilege, and like, it's what you know you dream as a kid when you trying to get into cycling. So, yeah, I mean, I feel lucky to be able to even, you know, ride those events.
Do any of last year's climbs stick out as memorable for either being breathtaking or never want to return, whether that's a Willunga down and the Tour Down Under or any of the Italian climbs that you had to pass through the tour?
I mean, I think the hardest climb from last year would have been in Badlands, which was actually like an ultra event when you climbed up the back of Sierra Nevada there. And yeah, that was horrible. Super long. And I did it in the middle of the night. And super rocky, pretty hard to ride. So yeah, that was by far the most difficult. I'd never ridden the Stelvio before, which is a tough climb, but mm-hmm. it's so iconic and beautiful that you kind of it's a bit of a freebie, you know, because like, it's kind of inspiring in itself. Mm-hmm. So you kind of takes the sting out of the legs a bit because you're kind of just wrapped up in being there. I think that was probably the hardest climb in the Giro, just given where it came. Like, it was on the back of four or five really hard days, and it was the last climb of the day second last climb of the day where we were doing over 5,000 meters, I think. So that was the most difficult climb of the race, but also for me, probably the most enjoyable.
Just talking of climbing and iconic climbs, in the middle of lockdown, obviously in the middle of this COVID world, you took on the Everest attempt mid-lockdown, and I believe you had to take it on twice, is that correct? On a segment where you just repeat that same segment and climb the height of Everest equivalent. What's that like, and is that something that you would have a go at again, or is that a once or a two-time thing, obviously with the circumstance?
I mean, to be honest, it's exactly what you think it would be like, which is kind of unique. Because normally you take on something epic and you have this idea of what it's going to be like. And generally I find that those, you know, the reality of what it is and your idea of what it is are very different. But with Everesting, it's exactly what you think, you know. It's just, it's monotonous and it's difficult, you know. Like you have, like I think I did 40 laps or something like that. So you just slowly get worse, you know. Like you start off, it feels that the pace you're sort of trying to hold, especially if you're trying to do it fast, the pace you're sort of holding feels like quite maintainable and within your limits. And then after a few hours, you know, it gets tougher. And then for the last 2 hours, you're kind of just hanging on for dear life. And also where I did it was quite high, like elevation wise. I think it was all over 2,500 meters, which made it like a lot less enjoyable again. So yeah, I don't think I would do it again. I won't say never, you know, if like if we're still locked up inside in 6 months' time, like anything's possible. But it's not like, it's not at the top of the list to do it again, you know. It wasn't, I'm glad to have done it, but it didn't inspire something inside me that, you know, I want to go chase Everest in different places or something.
Well, hopefully there isn't that block in the calendar that we lose to another pandemic or whatever it may be. And you're back out racing with EF as soon as possible. There are some quality guys in that team, whether that's Mitch Docker, Lawson Craddock, Mike Woods, Alex Howes, Iran, Higuita, Bettiol, TJ, the list goes on and on. How much fun are the camps? How much fun are those guys and being away with them when you go on either a training camp or at these the road races that you head around the world with?
Yeah, it's a really good group of guys. I think that's kind of the special ingredient that like our team's kind of found in the last couple of seasons. This is, we have like a very diverse group of riders. In that, you know, we have people from every corner of the world, but no one takes it too serious, or no one takes themselves too seriously. And it's kind of a bit of a family atmosphere, you know. It's a sort of team where we kind of appreciate each other's differences, and there's no mold that anyone's sort of trying to fit into, which is very unique, I think, in professional cycling. Normally, you sort of go away to a team camp or head to a race, and you kind of got to put this different face on, you know, work face for like a week, and then you go home and you can be yourself. But that sort of that's not the case on our team. So yeah, a really good group of guys who you don't really, I don't really care who you end up rooming with or who ends up on the race. You know, we're all pretty good mates. And I actually genuinely sort of look forward to getting away racing. And that sort of goes for the staff as well. It's very much like a big family. So, yeah, I think of all the teams that I personally could be involved with, I don't think I would rather be anywhere else.
That's awesome. And then from that, I guess, what are the team ambitions for the year? There's some great GC talent in the ranks, along with the depth of talent pool for other events. And then I guess ultimately, where does that leave you with any specific on-road targets that may well be for 2021?
Yeah, I mean, the team always has like a lot of different ambitions. I think like Hugh Carthy for as a like an emerging GC guy is like pretty exciting. And I'm sure he'll be targeting something, well, one of the Grand Tours. And then you've got Rigo, who is just an absolute legend and huge ability. So I'm sure he's targeting a Grand Tour. And also Hagida is coming up as like a huge emerging talent. So I think for the Grand Tour sort of GC ambitions, you've got those guys. And then obviously... got Bettiol in the classics, and with that like addition of Valgren, I think they're going to be a really good combo. So I think, yeah, I mean, I imagine they're the biggest sort of ambitions, like an obvious goals. But to be honest, when it's like such a long and tough sit, like there's so many races that we do, and I don't think anyone really, well, the atmosphere that we have, we're not prioritizing anything over another race. We always go in and try and give everything on the given day, so you can have all the goals you want, but ultimately it just sort of comes down to getting out there and putting the most into every opportunity you have. So, I mean, as far as where that leaves me, I think I'll be doing more of the alternate racing again. But yeah, hopefully I'll have another Grand Tour in there somewhere, and going to be a couple of longer stage races that I can get in there and get involved.
Awesome. You mentioned there potentially more alternative events, and you are well recognized globally for your off-road escapades, spearheading the RAFA and the EF alternative race program, whether that's riding Leadville, Dirty Kanzer, GB Duro, Three Peaks. How did the alternative calendar become a reality and almost this recognizable video documentary that EF and RAFA now use as A, such a massive promotional tool, but B, it's just a great advert for what more there is to cycling?
Yeah, I mean, it was something that I'd spoken with Rafa with about and wanted to be involved with. And at that time, I didn't realize that they were actually going to find like a world tour partner. And then EF sort of came on board with it. And I kind of saw it for the unique opportunity that it was or is. Yeah, just grabbed it with both hands and wanted to be involved, because I think a lot of what it is about, it sort of resonates with me. And I think it's sort of, not only is it sort of, it's fun to be involved with, but I think it kind of highlights areas that, you know, potentially opportunities that aren't really being pursued with men's road cycling, and I think just cycling on the whole, you know, there's so many different events, different disciplines and just different people involved in the sport that I guess don't really get the coverage or recognition that they maybe deserve. I think it's a disproportionate amount of coverage that men's road cycling gets, so it's cool to be involved in something that kind of maybe broadens the horizons of the audience that would normally follow our team, and then potentially, you know, brings people outside of our little world into our world, and ultimately it's just the goal of the whole program, just to get more people interested in riding bikes. So that's kind of the goal of it. And yeah, to be involved in something like that, that's a bit bigger than just chasing like personal results, is rewarding. So yeah, it's a cool program, and one that I feel pretty lucky to be involved with.
Are there any of those events that you have taken part in thus far that particularly stand out as being enjoyable and incredible experiences? And then I guess the second caveat to that question is, which events in the future would you like to target, possibly ones that were cancelled in 2020, moving forward to 2021, when hopefully these participation events can come back?
Yeah, it's pretty hard to single any out, to be honest, because I've had such different and, you know, overwhelmingly positive experiences at all of them. So it's hard to single out any event and be like, you know, I had the best time here. I think like when I did GB Duro, that probably had the biggest impact on me personally, just because it was kind of like a bit of a shift in mindset towards like what riding and racing can look like. But, you know, I also really, I enjoy the events that have like a very big, like participation and sort of community element.
So like when you look at like things, yeah,
exactly. They're really cool. I mean, they're just events that make sense. It's bigger than, a sponsor or, you know, someone trying to prove how good they are. It's just kind of, it's an event that not only recognizes the athletes, but, you know, the place they're competing and the people who are spectating and putting the event on. So,
Do you feel like you go to those events with a point to prove, or do you just go purely because you enjoy it, because there is an opportunity to take part in something completely different and experience, as you say, these community events?
No, I don't have a point to prove. For me, it's more just about getting involved and seeing what it's about. And also recognizing the fact that there are people who are very good at specific disciplines outside of road cycling, you know. Look at Three Peaks. Like, you know, I got my ass kicked by a few guys who were like over 40. And it's not like I didn't feel bad about it at all. Like, those guys are incredible.
They say with that one, you've got to do it two or three times to know it, though. So you'll have to go back.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, that's the appeal of it, right? I think that's sort of the hallmark of a good event. No, definitely not. No point to prove in regards to performance. The only point to prove is that I'm sort of willing to jump into the majority of bike-related scenarios and give it a crack.
Do you feel as though you identify one way more than other in terms of being an on or an off-road cyclist, or are you just almost a cyclist and experiencing what you do and wherever that journey takes you?
I think I'm just a cyclist. I'm not like, you know, I mean, I think when I'm at home, I've got like three bikes that I probably use equally. And it's sort of just about like me looking at the day, how I'm feeling and what sort of motivates me at that very point in time. And then I'll decide what sort of riding I'm going to do. I'm not like chasing a specific goal in a specific discipline. I'm just sort of trying to enjoy bikes for everything they can be.
I guess my last question, therefore, is related to that a little bit in terms of which bike you take out in the morning when you go out for your ride and for your training, etc. In terms of mileage and things like that you would do daily or weekly or monthly, whatever it might well be, obviously you prepare for very different things. How much does what bike you take out dictate how far you go on a day and how you're feeling for that training session almost?
Yeah, I mean, it's... like I've kind of worked out like miles or kilometers, they're kind of irrelevant to the majority of training that I do. I could ride my mountain bike here and do 70K and it might take me 7 hours just because the terrain's so tough. Or I could do that on the road bike and, you know, click off 200K. So I guess I'm normally riding somewhere around 30 hours a week, sometimes more, sometimes less, but that's probably my average, I guess. And I would say normally it's probably 50% on my, well, not even anymore, maybe like 30% on my road bike. And then probably 60% on the mountain bike, and then another 10% on the gravel bike, I guess. That's probably how it kind of looks at the moment. But I mean, that changes. But I mean, that's if I'm at home with no specific goal, that's kind of how it looks. Mm-hmm.
No, it's awesome. It's a fascinating insight. Lachlan, you are far more than just a member of the peloton. And again, once I'd like to reiterate, we thank you so much for your time. You're a world-class rider, incredibly fun bloke to talk to and hear your stories of. They say never meet or speak to your heroes, but from someone who follows cycling and follows both on-road and the off-road alternative calendar, I look forward to the next Rafa EF blog, vlog, whatever it may well be, and where your journey takes you next. Thank you so much for your time. Wish you all the very best for your upcoming season and all of your endeavours.
No worries. Thanks for having me, mate.
That was a fascinating insight, and obviously we'll be following the Giro d'Italia with aplomb as the next 3 weeks go on. It'd be interesting, A, to see some crowds there following them, but also to see which of the Grand Tour riders will be able to compete. And obviously, we will also be following Lachlan on his journey, both through the alternative calendar and on the World Tour and the Grand Tours, should he be selected. But you guys, you gave out your predictions for the playoffs from the championship for coming up. I think before we leave, I'll maybe throw my two pence into the mix. I don't see Swansea getting out of there, despite Freddie Woodman and his golden glove in the championship. I think they've been garbage for a little while, and that might not be his fault. I think the winner of the playoffs comes from that Brentford-Bournemouth game, and purely on form, nothing against Johnny Woodgate, I'm going to go for Brentford to come up. So I think Ivan Toney stays in London, and I think they come up, and I think they go straight back down, to be honest. But anything to add from that, gentlemen?
No, just another good week.
Yeah, enjoy the rest of your week.
Jimmy, stay batting, Jimmy.
No danger of that.
See you soon, lads.
Take care, gents.
See you, lads.
Bye. I'm the cat with the bass and drum, going around like bum, bum, bum.